Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up today, we'll discuss bankruptcy news from Toys R Us once again as we get some clarity on their bankruptcy processes. We'll also talk about Bed Bath & Beyond's disappointing earnings, and we'll wrap up the show by discussing how holiday sales may go up another 4% this year. Our interview guest today is Monica Kocher, who's the CEO and co-founder of Smart Gift. She's going to talk about some of the gifting momentum surrounding the holidays and also e-commerce gifting developments. But first this, you know about the perks that come with owning your own business, like financial freedom, being your own boss, and having more control of your time, but maybe you're just not sure where to start. However, all of these benefits could be yours if you decide to open a UPS store franchise.
It's something to surely think about if you want to start your own business. And the UPS store has over 35 years of franchising experience and was actually just ranked number 4 top franchise to own by Entrepreneur Magazine's 2017 Franchise 500 list. The UPS store offers stability, the support and reputation of a world-renowned brand, and a proven business model with all the training and marketing support you need to make your entrepreneurial dream come true.
Stores are available in large and small markets across the country, and their franchising experts will help you find a location that's just right for you. Plus, there's financing for those who qualify, so you don't need a ton of money up front, and special programs for military veterans. The time to promote yourself to business owner is now. Visit theupsstorefranchising.com/focus to get started today. That's theupsstorefranchising.com/focus. Leading off our show today, the fourth time is a charm for Walgreens as they recently got approval from the FTC to acquire over 1,900 Rite Aid locations in a modified deal that seeks to help both pharmacy retailers. Walgreens has been trying to acquire Rite Aid stores since 2015, but the deal kept getting modified slightly in order to look acceptable under the scrutiny of the FTC's antitrust concerns. It's no secret here that the pharmaceutical industry has been highly politicized in recent years, and for good reason. Companies, and not necessarily these consumer-facing retailers, have been accused of price gouging with prescription drugs and abusing patent loopholes to stave off the cheaper generic drugs. Walgreens, CVS, and Rite Aid are by far the largest standalone retail pharmacies in the U.S. by unit count. That doesn't include pharmacies that are inside, say, a Walmart or a Kroger. Walgreens CEO has a clear mission here of gaining market share in a time where the pharmaceutical industry is looking to grow by leaps and bounds over the next decade, thanks to more drug approvals and more drug approvals in the pipeline, as well as a larger insurance pool. Leighton, the story here again, this starts back in 2015 when Rite Aid and Walgreens began to discuss some form of merger or acquisition.
If you're a longtime listener of the Retail Focus, you're probably tired of hearing about this Walgreens Rite Aid deal, but we're actually probably tired of talking about it. It seems as though Walgreens was intent on acquiring at least some of these Rite Aid locations. And it's interesting because this most recent deal was actually a looking ahead story on a previous podcast, but then it ended up getting modified there again. So a lot of iterations of this deal. And if we go back to October of 2015, the original deal proposed was to be for all Rite Aid stores for around $9.4 billion. And you could see, if you look at the share price, the historical share price data from Rite Aid, shares had popped to around $8, $9 a share several times because a lot of shareholders thought this deal was going to get approved by the FTC. That deal, of course, got modified several times as a result, with Fred's Pharmacy actually being involved at one point to try to take some of the stores away from both Walgreens and Rite Aid. As for this latest deal, it looks to be finally a solid win for both companies. However, a win that did come at a cost, as Walgreens likely spent a pretty penny for lawyers and lobbyists across these last 2 years. Again, October of 2015, we've been talking about it for almost 2 years now on the podcast. This approved acquisition will encompass 1,932 stores. Trent said over 1,900. That is to be the case, roughly 254 less than the deal put forth just a few months ago. So the modification was actually a reduction by around 250 stores. This was labeled as a last-minute tweak to make sure the FTC actually accepted these modified terms. Walgreens will also buy Rite Aid's 3 distribution centers in Connecticut, Pennsylvania, and South Carolina as part of this deal. The price tag for the 1,900 Rite Aid stores was a bit less as a result of this reduced store count in the last-minute modification, coming in around $4.38 billion. Again, if you compare this to all of the Rite Aid stores, going to be paid for with $9.4 billion. You can see that this is roughly 45% of that, down from also the $5.18 billion for the 2,186 locations proposed just a couple months ago. What is maybe the most interesting part about this revised deal is that the purchase price per store is actually less now than before. $2.267 million per store now versus the $2.369 million per store previously. To put this in perspective, the complete buyout offer in October of 2015 for all the Rite Aid stores would have averaged actually just slightly above $2 million per store. So you can look at this and say that Walgreens is paying somewhat of a premium for this reduced store count, and it's extremely unclear to us as to whether these are underperforming stores or if they're overperforming, but Walgreens is not wanting to wait too long for this transition process as they are targeting locations to be transferred over in the next few weeks. They are likely to close the deal with all the 1,932 Rite Aid locations before the summer of 2018. And to be honest, if we were Walgreens and Walgreens executives, we would be eager to close this too. In a company statement, the Rite Aid locations that will be acquired will be mostly in the northeast and southern parts of the United States. It is unclear again as to the performance of these locations, but Walgreens is trying to put this behind them to try to make everything as streamlined as possible. In a statement, Republican Maureen Allhausen, the acting chairman of the FTC, which approved the deal, said a sharply smaller Rite Aid will still be able to effectively compete against Walgreens and other big U.S. chains such as CVS. Along with CVS, she did mention Kroger and Walmart. And to be honest with you, these do seem like competent pharmacies, as you had mentioned, Trent, at the beginning of this.
So here with this deal, other regulators issued continued fears that this would pose antitrust issues and that healthy competition was needed in retail overall. This is something that's come up multiple times. And you get the sense that these regulators that were issuing these fears for this deal, they view this as a potential slippery slope, even though it's a true shell of the former deals. And you wonder if this also sends a message to the rest of the retail community that potentially regulators might be more hesitant to accept mergers and acquisitions going forward rather than just giving their stamp of approval to everything. And again, we've seen a hesitant acquisition landscape over the last couple of years, not necessarily with, say, the Whole Foods Amazon deal, but we saw it certainly in the office supplies realm with Office Max, Office Depot, and Staples, and we may see it again in the future. After all, it took 2 years for Walgreens to tweak this deal to regulators' liking. Now let's look at what's next for both companies. With Rite Aid, this will mean nearly 42% reduction of its store count. They will, of course, get a much-needed cash infusion. Leighton mentioned the multi-billion dollar cash infusion they'll get, but it will likely be used to bring down the company's very large debt burden. However, this has the benefit of helping with interest expense going forward. The less interest expense there is, the more money is going to show up on the bottom line. The reduced store count will also, in theory, direct managers to focus on the remaining store base and making those locations once again profitable. Between this and a much healthier balance sheet and ever-growing pharmaceutical sales, including a number of generics and drugs that are in the pipeline of FDA approval that may be coming out in the next 2 to 3 years, it's possible to see positive adjusted earnings per share in the next 2 to 3 years in our view, but potentially as soon as the next 2 to 3 quarters, depending on when all of the legal stresses on the balance sheet filter out of the system. As for Walgreens, meanwhile, they will have now just over 10,000 locations in the United States, making it the number one retail pharmacy by unit count. CVS will now drop down to the number two spot with just over 9,600 locations. And as we've talked about share prices throughout the course of this story, it's only right that we wrap up the story by talking about the share prices for both businesses after this news. What is somewhat precarious is the fact that this news wasn't viewed in a positive light by many shareholders, particularly those from Walgreens. Perhaps, of course, shareholders have become numb to everything given this lengthy series of events. Again, a nearly two-year process to get this acquisition done for these businesses. Shares of Rite Aid have approached four-year lows in the last couple of months, nearing $2 per share. They popped upward towards $3 per share, but now Rite Aid shares have been slashed over 9% after the deal was announced, leaving shares around the $2.45 range, that is $2.45 per share. That leaves Rite Aid with a $2.52 billion market cap. And again, while Walgreens looks to extract more earnings potential out of these divested Rite Aid locations, given the deal's $2.269 million valuation per store and the remaining Rite Aid store base, Rite Aid's leftover portfolio could theoretically be worth around $6.4 billion or more if you just value it on a per share basis. So again, we feel like the market cap may be slightly low for Walgreens. However, we do have to factor in the company's current debt, which again, a lot will be paid off once this deal goes through, and their lower than average operating margins, which had dogged the business, one of the reasons why they had the debt load they did in the past. Walgreens shares, meanwhile, were down 1.8% initially, down another 2% since then to around $78 per share. Over the last 52 weeks, shares for the pharmacy giant have fluctuated between $76 and $88 per share. So Walgreens nearing the bottom end of their 52-week share prices.
We move on to a somewhat sad story turned a potential positive. And we spoke recently of the rumors, but it's now official as Toys R Us has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in an effort to restructure its enormous $5.2 billion debt load. The filing's release came on Monday of this week to the surprise of some, but not all, that had followed the company closely during the last few months in its operations. You can see that the company has been struggling, but without having all the pertinent information, we felt that the company would at least make it through the holiday season without any larger, more public moves to restructure. And this is something we had talked about previously, as we really thought they were going to be able to make it through the holiday season and potentially use that extra cash, as they do the majority of their sales during the last 3 months of the year, to maybe look to some creditors and try to strike some deals. And oftentimes we are wrong, and we were in this case. We were right in a way, though, in that Toys R Us executives had aggressively tried to either renegotiate the deals in place with its creditors before the holiday shopping season kicked off, or to get additional lines of credit either through the existing creditors or outside parties. Reason being, they didn't want to spook any vendors with a potential bankruptcy filing, making them think there would be an inability to pay for the merchandise funneling through their supply chain. And obviously, this is something that we have talked about a lot here in the recent past with a company such as Sears or JCPenney. It's oftentimes weary to really let everybody know in the public light that you're having problems with liquidity. You don't want to spook any of your suppliers, and then that would mean less products on the shelf, therefore less revenue, therefore less profit to pay back those original creditors. The company was trying to raise up to $200 million here recently in order to stay liquid and on top of their pricey interest payments. Those very interest payments were costing the company roughly $400 million per year. They were close to cinching up a sale-leaseback deal also, but were not able to come to terms on a short-term basis with some of their larger creditors there. According to company statements, they had been able to get better terms or additional lines of credit here and there in the recent past, but nothing substantial that would get them through in a healthy way to January of 2018. Again, they were really trying to target operating time to get them through the holiday season. The 69-year-old company is actually looking at this bankruptcy now via a glass half full approach. CEO David Brandon, a former Domino's CEO, in fact, turned that company around, has been with the company since June of 2015. He recently told Reuters in a statement that they came in with the mentality of, let's go ahead and get this done as quickly as possible so that it cannot interrupt the holiday season. And I think that's going to be a smart plan here, as they're receiving a lot of negative PR. But the sooner you get this done and over with, the sooner it's forgotten about. And if they can truly restructure the company and its current debt levels, I do see a positive future for Toys R Us, although I am bullish on the brick and mortar concept. You see, toys is a particular area that Amazon has wanted to come into along with the likes of JCPenney, but with the bankruptcy, they will now have enough short-term liquidity at least to maintain normal supply-side buying operations through the important holiday season, so we're not going to spook any vendors this time. That is good news for the store managers too, and that they may need the extra help on the sales floor, and so they're going to be able to hire those part-time associates to keep customers happy and wait times down at a minimum during the biggest times of the year for Toys R Us.
Every year, they make a big deal out of hiring a lot of part-time seasonal help and including new employees in different parts of the store, so much so, in fact, that they usually roll out a press release just before Black Friday talking about it. And according to the company, this year, they're still looking to hire tens of thousands of part-time workers as seasonal help. The company went on to say that its five largest metropolitan areas may see up to 9,600 workers added. In previous years, the company's total seasonal hiring has topped 40,000 employees. We recently spoke about Target's 100,000-plus team member hiring spree and how that could affect other retailers as they are hiring early in order to train. Target, that is hiring early, so there may be a dearth of physical employees out there to fulfill some of the seasonal hiring. While these jobs most likely lower skilled entry level jobs, that type of thing, the pool of candidates may be much shallower this year. Again, the unemployment rate is fairly low at 4.4%. Now, that doesn't include the people who have stopped looking for a job, but that number has also shrank. And so many companies will be needing people for online fulfillment centers and distribution. You've got a lot of companies looking to snap up workers in this way, almost a game of labor hungry hippos, if you will. And Walmart, an obvious and serious competitor to Toys R Us, recently said they'll be looking primarily towards their part-time staff to fulfill needs of their brick and mortar segment rather than fulfillment centers and distribution. Oftentimes, retailers can have their part-time employees work full-time hours. This is a way to kind of ratchet up hours without having to bring new people on board, do background checks, all of that stuff, while keeping them in part-time status as long as they don't work a number of consecutive work weeks at a certain level. So you can rotate people on and off of full-time employment, essentially, as the holidays get near. Some companies keep a rolling average of weekly hours to ensure some employees don't accidentally become full-time and therefore become eligible for certain benefits, including health insurance. But the point being overall that the job market may be very competitive this year. In order to hire some of these part-time seasonal workers, which in theory means higher pay, more flexible hours for those interested in a few months' worth of extra work, and earn income come the holiday seasons. Now, back to this Toys R Us deal specifically, a key point from this bankruptcy is that all of the 1,600 brick-and-mortar locations will stay open for the foreseeable future. And so when you see headlines out there like Toys R Us may be no longer, I think that's perhaps a little bit presumptuous, as those who have followed the company for a long period of time know that they've been under this enormous debt burden that is, as Layton has mentioned, costing them mounds every single year in terms of interest payments, $400 million anticipated for this year alone. So this is really just a way that CEO Dave Brandon and the rest of the management team can get out on top of their finances, as the finances have been turned around under his watch. It's a debt load that he basically assumed, and this is the best way to kind of restructure and help to clear that out, which will also, again, as with Rite Aid we talked about earlier, help that bottom line. And we were comforted to see a statement by Dave Brandon declaring that, and I quote, "These are the right steps to ensure the iconic Toys R Us and Babies R Us brands live on forever," end quote. In some cases, if they were in much worse financial distress, you might see them closing down the physical brick and mortar stores, selling off some of the land or some of the buildings that they hold, as they had talked about doing sale leasebacks prior. They would completely sell those off, use that to restructure the debt, and go almost completely e-commerce. But that's not happening here. Toys R Us operationally is doing reasonably well, and I think that's one of the reasons why Brandon and others at the company seem pretty optimistic about the company's future.
Yeah, he also stated that they expect financial constraints to be lifted once they have everything restructured, and this is going to be more in a permanent fashion for the company, so they won't have that lingering debt load, or at least they're going to have maturities in a much longer time frame. What this means is probably better overall terms for the company. Again, extending terms, lowering interest rates, consolidation, and potentially elimination of some debt via some creditors. Brandon wants to use freed up cash to reinvest in both brick and mortar, which we always like to see, and of course, online channels. He acknowledges the changing retail landscape in several of his statements. He mentioned how he does have to make sure the company adjusts to the digital landscape. The chain has already adapted its online platform to match consumers' digital demands somewhat, but they arguably need to do much better. A good loyalty system would be a good start, and potentially teaming up with major brands like Mattel to promote new items on the main pages of their digital footprints as well. Cohen Research Group recently reported that 41% of toys and games in the United States would be purchased online this calendar year. 41% really took us by surprise, doubling the e-commerce toy pie versus the 2009 figures. For right now, though, JP Morgan and other lenders will be giving the company $3 billion in bankruptcy financing to pay its vendors and employees through the upcoming proceedings. And we hope that Toys R Us, Babies R Us, and the executive teams there are working diligently to make sure the company can stay afloat. And like the CEO said, keep the company around forever.
Well, we talked about it at the beginning of the show, but there are a lot of perks that come with owning your own business. Financial freedom being one of them, and of course, who doesn't enjoy being their own boss? Having more control of your time, maybe so much control that you get to start your own podcast. All of this could be yours potentially if you choose to open a UPS store franchise.
It is certainly something to think about, and the UPS store has over 35 years of franchising experience to bring to the table. They were actually just ranked the number 4 top franchise to own by Entrepreneur Magazine's 2017 Franchise 500 list. The UPS store offers that stability, the support, and reputation of a world-renowned brand, and a proven business model with all the training and marketing support you'll need to make your entrepreneurial dream come true. Stores are available in both large and small markets across the United States, and their franchising experts will help you find a location that's just right.
Plus, there's financing for those who qualify and special programs for military veterans. The time to promote yourself to business owner, if you haven't done so already, is now. Visit theupsstorefranchising.com/focus to get started today. That's theupsstorefranchising.com/focus. So last month, a company came to our attention that aims to change the way in which gifting works, particularly gifting online. And, you know, today everyone's talking about disruption, especially as it pertains to retail. But a company named SmartGift appears uniquely positioned to create true change in a gifting dynamic that's rarely reached beyond gift cards and discount codes. And we're not the only ones at the Retail Focus podcast who see the potential here. SmartGift was actually twice honored with MasterCard at the 2017 Pay Before Awards, both as a winner in the gift card innovation category and as best in category. So our guest today is Monica Kocher, the co-founder and CEO of that very business. She's got a dynamic background, not only an entrepreneur, but also a background in product innovation, marketing, and leadership. Monica, first off, as we get started, you know, before we talk about SmartGift as a concept, much of your innovation regarding SmartGift and much of where your company has gone now has come from, it's data-driven, it's research-driven, really looking at the psychology of gifting. So as you looked at some of the data and as your partners looked at some of the data, what were some of your findings that suggested that maybe there was a way to improve upon how we were gifting?
Yeah, I mean, gifting is such a complex cycle, right, interaction. And actually, as a matter of fact, in October 2013, when we had, you know, I'd spoken at Fashion Digital in New York and had given a whole talk around the complex psychology and the economics of gift, the gift-giving exchange. So while it's one of the probably the oldest traditions that we have among, you know, humans, it's also very deeply rooted in social obligation, right? So there's a whole idea of building the social contract, the whole idea of alliances, you know, all of that. So when we looked at gifting, and look, particularly looking at gifting for online world, we said, well, listen, you know, the user journey in gifting, it's a roller coaster journey. It's an emotional roller coaster where you say, oh, first of all, oh, the birthday is coming up, or that particular occasion is coming up. You know, am I too late? Is it going to arrive there on time? What should I get the person? Will they like it? Will they not like it? So it's a lot of hassle, but also it's very full of anxiety. And on the recipient side, the recipient is kind of just like waiting, right? Like, oh, I wonder what's going to happen. And they're very excited, whether it's their birthday or Christmas or anniversary. So for us, it was so obvious that, well, the consumer, the customer experience in gifting was really broken, right? Because yes, you have the gift card. By the way, if you look at the user journey of the gift card, it solves for the lows because sure, you can never get a bad gift, but it also completely flattens out the highs because ultimately you're just saying, hey, Trent, here's some money for you, go buy yourself something. So given where experiences have gone, just like fundamentally experiences have completely, you know, transformed, right? Digital experiences. We expect beautiful, design-centric, personalized experiences. And that's really for us was a crux of Smart Gift, where a gift sender can really give you anything, right? I can be on a retail site. I can say, oh, I really think Trent's going to like this. I give it to you in a way that you and I communicate, whether it's through text messaging or WhatsApp or Messenger. And then you can really, you have this beautiful interactive experience of opening the gift. You can choose whether it's a size or a color or a flavor, or even say, hey, Monica, I have enough backpacks. Let me go for something else. And you can go for something altogether different. And all of this is happening before the gift ships, right? So ultimately, it's about how do you make the gift recipient happy? How do you make the gift sender happy? And really speak to them in that moment of need, whether it's last minute, whether it's like, I don't know what to give, but I feel like I want to do this. I want to be thoughtful, but you know, I want to make sure they like it. So it's really kind of checkboxing all those decisions. Gifting is full of decisions, actually, at the end of the day.
One of the things that you touched on that I find interesting is this idea that, you know, the sender, there's some level of expectation there and anticipation that's built up. And there's this, you know, expectancy violation that might go on if the gift isn't what they were expecting or if the gift is disappointing on that end. What are some ways in which Smart Gift helps to not only reduce expectancy violation, but kind of carve out that top end of excitement that you were referencing?
Yeah. So one of the things is that we're tapping into conversational commerce or conversational experience, which is what gifting is. It's essentially an interaction between two people or many people, right? But it's an interaction between, you know, two humans, let's say. So with Smart Gift, very important thing for us was how do you really authentically mimic that? And how do you bring that into the digital world, but also physical, right? So let's say it's Valentine's Day and you're taking your partner out for dinner. Well, you should be able to Smart Gift your partner something while you're actually having a cocktail. You know, and she or he can still unwrap it, can still go ahead and have that full experience. So one of the things we do is we have this beautiful interactive wrapper that you really kind of, you know, take your finger on and you unwrap it. And then again, it's all about how do you communicate with each other? It's very natural. So it's not a retailer saying, hey, Trent, here's Monica sending you a gift, but it's really me sending you that gift in the way that you and I will always talk.
You mentioned the wrapper, and actually for our listeners out there, you can go to smartgiftit.com and kind of see a demo on how that wrapper works, where it's very physical. You have to kind of unwrap the gift only in a digital space. How did you guys arrive upon that idea to kind of transfer the opening of a gift into the digital realm where it's more than just above and beyond reading an email or reading a text message?
That's a great question. So Smart Gift at its heart is really a user-centric company. We really pride ourselves in design. We're based in Brooklyn. And for us, user experience, user journeys, how do you map design, really like borrowing from the natural world of how people are really doing things and bringing it to digital world, that's really what it's all about for us. You know, of course, it's about the business, but ultimately, if the user journey is right, the business flows. And we were thinking about that wrapper, and we had so many ideas around, and there's certain things that we're still working on, actually, like gamification, right? So puzzle. So imagine if you can just lock the wrapper to a particular place or a geolocation. So you can only unwrap your gift in a park or in that on that bench where you first met, right? So there's a lot of things we feel that the wrapper can do. The wrapper is ultimately an idea of play. It's an idea of engagement. But also it's an idea of, you know, unwrapping a gift. And one of the big things about gift is that a gift is not a gift until it's wrapped. Therefore, the whole idea about, like, you know, tying a ribbon digitally around it, really wrapping it up, is actually a very important part of the aesthetics of gifting, but also in the psychology of gifting.
That's interesting, especially from a sender-receiver standpoint. I want to look at it now from a retailer's perspective. Can you explain a little bit about how Smart Gift works on the part of a retailer if I'm an e-commerce website that might be interested in setting this type of thing up?
Yeah, absolutely. So we are B2B2C, if you will. And our platform, so we, you know, we came out of the MasterCard Accelerator Commerce Innovated in February. We graduated from that. And for us, it was really about how do you create an implementation which is really easy for our retail partners. Because ultimately, it's about bandwidth, it's priorities, you know, things need to be easy for them to really be able to just turn this on and start seeing that incremental revenue flow. So you can think of Smart Gift as completely over-the-top gifting. And what we do is we have a product feed that we take from them. It's like an affiliate model. And we really give them back a Smart Gift experience. And a big part of it for us was decoupling commerce from payments so that all the transactions are really happening on the retailer's site. So the customer is going back and paying on their site, and we are really enabling the perfect gifting experience for them and also capturing a lot of crucial gifting data that we give back to them.
Our guest today on the Retail Focus podcast is Monica Kocher. She's the co-founder and CEO of Smart Gift. And to this point, we've talked a little bit about how Smart Gift works from various different sources, but you also talked about the financial aspect of Smart Gift in your last answer. And I think this is also something that I find fascinating, where oftentimes the gifter doesn't necessarily need to be handcuffed by putting in financial data immediately or putting in payment data immediately. And so you create this really interesting IOU system. Can you talk a little bit to how this end of it works?
Yes, absolutely, Trent. So yes, what we are doing, exactly as you said, is take a step back, right? First of all, you only have two transactions. One is where you buy for yourself, and the other transaction is when you're buying for someone else. Now, when you're buying for someone else, is inherently a social obligation. It's an exchange where you're saying to somebody, I'm giving you this. And if you think about it from that perspective, payments should really be coming all the way at the end of that exchange. So what we did is we really turned gifting on its head. And we said, well, we had another model in the market previously, which was about paying first. And we saw there's a lot of shopping cart abandonment because you're asking people to enter their credit card information. So they already need to know. They already need to be sure that they want to give you this, right? So when you take payments all the way to the end, it's completely friction-free. You're removing all kinds of hurdles along the way. And simply, you're putting something that's the most painful part of any exchange, putting in your credit card information, paying for something all the way to the end, and moving the most pleasant part of the exchange, handing the gift, saying, hey, here's the gift for you, happy birthday, all the way in the front. And by doing that, we just saw enormous lift. Not to mention, try and buy has really become the crux of sort of everything in digital now. And so we really enable customers to be able to try Smart Gift, and the second time, the third time, the fourth time they come, and they send a gift that way, because they're so comfortable with it. They understand, like, oh, this is how it works. And they can go ahead and do it without having to put in any credit card information or committing right away. So we're seeing incredible conversion. The social obligation is just really, really powerful in gifting.
We've talked about how data-driven your company is. And earlier I referenced expectancy violation on the part of the receiver, but there's also some of that potential on the part of the sender too, because you do have to essentially spend money on something. And if it's not what the receiver wanted, then you can feel a letdown, certainly psychologically. Based on what you've heard back from senders that use Smart Gift, does it seem like the transaction is maybe more pleasant from their perspective simply because they know they are for sure spending money on something that the recipient wants or needs?
Absolutely. For senders, the comfort of knowing that, Katie accepted the gift, she chose her preferences, and now I'm going to pay for it, is very vital to the entire system to work. And also, I think it's rooted in there's no fear left, there's no insecurity left, right? And if you kind of even like look at the gift card, you know, you send the gift card to somebody, but you actually still never know if the recipient did ever utilize it, if they actually ever did get a gift with it, right? So with this pay later mechanism, we are really giving just complete comfort around that interaction.
We have a lot of retailers that listen to this particular program, and for them, the term breakage is going to be fairly familiar, but basically that's the amount of a gift card, a traditional gift card, that goes unused. And there's kind of this gray area between when you turn it from a liability to revenue. There's still not a ton of clarity on that aspect. And something that we kind of discovered when talking to you before the interview is that under SmartGift and the SmartGift program, there really is no such thing as breakage. So there's no financial or accounting gray area. Have the retailers that you've partnered with so far been relatively thankful that it seems to iron out the financial side of things?
Yes, exactly. And I remember when you and I had spoken about it, and it was very interesting for me to see how you already knew about all of that, right? Because so many times people don't even know about that breakage, the liability potentially of a gift card that just sits there. But you had brought that point up. Exactly. So what we're seeing with a lot of our merchant partners is they're actually just moving straight to SmartGift. You know, they're completely obfuscating the e-gift card because there's, of course, there's breakage, there's leakage, there's also like fraud, et cetera, around it, right? And SmartGift is not only the product level gifting technology platform, but it taps into social commerce, it taps into conversational commerce. It's really an experience. It's an experience-driven gifting technology. So yes, we're seeing that our retail partners are really excited, and the experience is just phenomenal for not just them, but for also their customers and the recipients. But also a very important part is the data. You know, so we're being able to give them so much data, right? To be able to have that granular view of their gift commerce is also very exciting for them to know who was the sender, who was the recipient, did they use text message or email? You know, what did the recipient ultimately like? What did they go for? What size are they? To be able to kind of retarget them, segment them in those ways creates a lot more incremental business opportunities for them to keep the conversation going and to even extend a whole new conversation to a recipient.
And the recipient, of course, finds out about the gift via text, chat, WhatsApp. You talked about those options earlier, but it really seems to remove the burden off of the retailer in terms of notification, and also helps out that connectivity if a customer, let's say, were to give a gift to a recipient in a common location, as you were talking about earlier. Do you feel as though from the retailer's perspective, this kind of washes their hands of some of that process a little bit so that you can actually generate conversion on that gift giving?
Completely, Trent. So there were the days, right, in e-commerce where the brands and the retailers were like, oh, we want to reach out to the customer. But actually what you soon started realizing was, well, customers are being over-marketed to. There is a complete fatigue of what, another 10% off and another this and another that. And so we said, well, that doesn't make any sense. And it's also not real. It's not genuine gifting. So from SmartGift's perspective, when you as a friend are reaching out to your friend or a colleague or mother to daughter, you know, all those relationships, that's really where the genuine gifting is happening. And our merchant partners really like that because they're part of a genuine conversation. They're not just like slyly getting in there and saying, hey, you have a gift from XYZ, but they're actually enabling that in a very beautiful, real way that the recipient opens. So the timing for us open, I think the average is under 6 hours, and most of them are availed within like 6 minutes. So, you know, you have this conversation between two people, and the retailer is a part of it because it's their product, but they're doing it in a very elegant and a very real way.
I want to ask you very quickly also about the age group of the SmartGift customers to this point. I know a lot is made of targeting the millennial demographic and a younger demographic. What is the approximate age range of the typical SmartGift customer, if you will?
We are seeing it's very wide range, right? So from some of our merchant partners that are predominantly in the millennial market, even in the younger market, to ones that really have, you know, 40s and 50-year-olds as their customer base. And we are seeing that whole gamut because ultimately everybody is online, everybody is texting or emailing, and it's part of that communication. And they're using SmartGift in the ways that they're normally doing things. So maybe like in the 40s and 50s, dynamics, maybe they're not texting as much, but then they're smart gifting by email. But we've seen plenty of mom and dads texting a smart gift to their children saying, hey son, here's a backpack. The age range has been just really wide for us. I think ultimately we all just really love experiences, right? And the right experience matters.
Absolutely. Experience basically has no age range, to put it that way. You know, we've got the holiday season approaching, and it's going to be here before retailers even know it. But even beyond that, you've got Valentine's Day, you've got things like Mother's Day, Father's Day, all of that. Kind of looking into the distance over the next 6 to 12 months or even over the next couple of years, where do you see gifting as a movement kind of going?
I think, you know, this is really just the beginning. I think the movement, like all of their fundamental transformations is going to be experiential. I know that our team, our fantastic team at SmartGift, is going to constantly pushing the boundaries of design, of experiences, of also just innovating payments, right, and commerce. But I think there's so much more going to happen. Now think about it, augmented reality. So now I just unwrap my gift, but imagine if I could actually experience my gift even in a much more interesting way, in a more dynamic way, right? There's virtual reality. Like imagine through that gifting exchange, you could be immersing the customer even more. So I think there's so much that's going to happen within gifting, but ultimately I think it's going to become just as expressive as when you're giving that person face-to-face that perfect gift and they smile back and give you that beautiful hug, you know, and they're going to be able to recreate all of that digitally.
It's amazing stuff. Monica Kocher, the co-founder and CEO of SmartGift, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thanks, Trent. It was such a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, we'd like to thank Monica for once again coming on and discussing some of those dynamics regarding e-commerce gifting. We'll also catch up with Monica after shop.org approaching next week and talk to her about how the conference went, talk to her about some of the trends that she noted in gifting throughout the duration of the conference. And once again, our conference coverage from shop.org beginning next week is brought to you by Gain Loans and GainLoans.com. To become a pilot retailer for Gain Loans, contact them at info@gainloans.com. That's GANE loans.com. Well, we push on towards the second half of the show with news on Tuesday from Bed Bath & Beyond as they posted depressing second quarter results that are causing us personally and many other analysts to wonder exactly what the future holds for the massive company. Shares down around 17% since the formal release on Tuesday. Here's some of the numbers straight from the company here. The company reported net earnings of 67 cents per diluted share, comes out to $94.2 million on an overall basis, including the unfavorable impacts, this is, of approximately 8 cents per diluted share of cash restructuring charges associated with, and I quote, the acceleration of the realignment of their store management structure as announced on August 3rd of 2017. There were also some estimated costs here that were written out associated with the impact of Hurricane Harvey. Those were estimated at 2 cents per diluted share, and the impact of the new share-based payment accounting standard, and those impacts about 1 cent per diluted share compared with $1.11 per diluted share for the fiscal 2016 second quarter. Analysts polled FactSet expected earnings per share of 93 cents here coming into the earnings release. So no matter the figure, earnings were going to be down year over year anyway. You had on an adjusted basis $1.11 per diluted share in last year's second quarter. Analysts expected 93 cents this quarter. It came in even lower than both of those at 67 cents per diluted share. So the company's earnings vastly down year over year. Revenue was also a $100 million miss as the company brought in just $2.9 billion. That's down $90 million year over year. Analysts expected an increase in revenue but a decrease on the bottom line. As it turned out, both numbers decreased. And comp sales were down 2.6%. So comparable store sales there, while non-comparable sales from some of their digital channels like One Kings Lane and PMall were up 0.9%. One Kings Lane has been a hindrance somewhat in terms of operations, and we see through these numbers that the increase of 0.9%, far less than a number of e-commerce brands, including those e-commerce brands that are kind of legacy or online-only e-commerce brands, as those two. Physical store comps were said to be in the negative mid-single-digit range. Decrease in transactions were offset very, very slightly by an increase in average basket. So basically what this is saying is that their brick and mortar channels need to get more people in through the door. Their overall digital revenue, however, was up 20% year over year, thanks very little to the One Kings Lane and PMall sites there, which again were up less than a percent. So their digital revenue going up by about the industry standard. We talk about robust e-commerce sales increases of 15 to 20% for most retailers. Bed Bath & Beyond seeing that here, but some of the online brands they brought into their portfolio are underperforming, and the brick and mortar stores are underperforming, even as inventory expense was slightly lower than last year, as the company cited efficiencies in their supply chain.
The company's CEO, Stephen Tamaris, currently holds a job few envy right now as the company is going through sort of its own restructuring. They talked about really trying to retrain management and to try to actually increase staffing at some of their locations. But we mentioned the hurricanes affecting the bottom line. That was a problem with Irma and Harvey affecting close to 200 locations, or at least that's what they had mentioned during the conference call. But Tamaris noted that many of the locations were actually quick to open thanks to their dedicated associates. Only one store ended up suffering major damage and is actually still closed to this day. As we go back to the business trends, they saw what everyone has been experiencing for the most part, softer than normal traffic in store in those physical stores, and increased traffic on the digital platforms. A new IT model is going to be rolled out in terms of structure and in leadership. They said they have a new CIO and a new chief technology officer as well. Streamlined communication will help teams devote resources where they are most needed. This is something that's very logical, but actually something they didn't have in place previously. They've been adjusting quickly to new challenges and the evolution on their platforms, all while looking towards cost savings in the future. Perhaps the cost savings, a more likely idea 10 to 15 years down the line in our view. They really shouldn't, as a retailer that's trying to evolve, see or at least try to relate to cost savings in terms of short-term IT infrastructure, but only in terms of the processes these IT infrastructure plans help to facilitate. So we're talking about supply chain efficiencies, point of sale systems, making it quicker for data gathering and those types of things. And then also loyalty data. Those types of things are going to save costs in the long term. But oftentimes you see retailers saying that they're going to be saving in IT only to revamp these processes, this hardware, in 4 to 5 years down the line. I think the same thing is going to be here for Bed Bath & Beyond, because honestly, overall, this is a company that is trying to invest heavily in its omni-channel. They talked a lot about during the conference call their very vast brick and mortar presence throughout the United States. Speaking of that, in-store fulfillment and the tools necessary to execute on this front are keys, according to management, something we recently heard from Target's seasonal hiring spree. Unlike Target, however, Bed Bath & Beyond seems to be much further behind in this overall process of training and trying to get different inventory systems in place on the floor. While Target is moving on with new iterations of in-store handhelds, we recently talked about moving on to an Android system from an Apple system, Bed Bath & Beyond is just now getting a feel for how human capital could be better allocated. We're talking about between being a cashier, being a stocker, and then also fulfilling online orders. It gets very complex. And overall, related to that very staffing need, the company is focused on filling up more potential holes on the sales floor to try to negotiate this. And this ties into store management restructuring costs also that hindered their earnings per share figures. They're really trying to figure out the best way to manage their managers and their store associates. So right now, while doing that, they have to face the online pressures that Amazon is bringing to the table. And they have to be training their associates with new e-learning systems, all very expensive, while you see a decline in that bottom line.
During this call, they essentially morphed customer experience into everything, which, again, may not be the right focus for the retailer, especially when there are so many things that they need to tweak and need to work on. And again, traffic numbers, the big key here. So there's something that's not either drawing people into the stores or not drawing people to buy. And we're not entirely sure that it's the customer experience aspect of their business that's keeping people from doing that. Customer-centric objectives were tied into the idea during the call that their products should be high quality at a value price point. It seems like every business just about in this particular sector of niche retail is talking about this type of thing. They mentioned 200,000 more furniture and home decor SKUs with One Kings Lane. A lot of talk of One Kings Lane, which again, an acquisition that many questioned, including us, because it wasn't as if One Kings Lane was ultra popular or profitable. And we see how little One Kings Lane sales really affected the bottom line at Bed Bath & Beyond. And even their same store sales, or in this case, same site sales, didn't go up all that much over the last year. They also wanted more furniture in Bye Bye Baby and World Market, which already has a significant amount of furniture, at least the latter does.
Private label items were also mentioned during the call, as well as more services, the latter of which could actually tie in with some of that customer experience aspect, including decorating services, furniture assembly being rolled out, and that type of thing. However, Bed Bath & Beyond is kind of in an opposite forum as where these services have been working out. If you look at the Container Store, for example, they typically service a higher income clientele. We talked about Bassett Furniture recently and their design services. Again, higher income clientele there. But Bed Bath & Beyond in this earnings call alone was talking about value price points, and it's not the folks that are buying at value price points that are really going to be looking to spend money on some of these services. So this is kind of a 1 foot half in one land and 1 foot half in the other land type of deal for Bed Bath & Beyond. Above and beyond that, in terms of what we're slightly critical of here, we think they're making a risky PR move because the company has mentioned they're rolling out more dynamic pricing, which is more something that we see in kind of the QSR and FSR realm in the restaurant world than what we see in retail. Essentially, what this means is they're making market-based pricing adjustments to compete more aggressively in certain geographical areas. And of course, all companies do comps, including Walmart and Costco with other retailers in a geographic area. But in the e-commerce realm, this is sometimes criticized and looked at as discriminatory. Amazon's similar practices, for example, have caused the company to come under fire with significant negative press around that particular practice, and some calling for more consistent pricing across the board. So sometimes you open up a Pandora's box as far as PR is concerned by rolling these type of things out. Despite troubles in finding their digital footing overall with some of their additional websites, again, Bed Bath & Beyond's own website still up over 20%. Sequential comps increases have now brought digital-facing sales up to 15% of total revenue, which, as we'll mention here in a little bit, is actually above the overall retail landscape. So they are a little bit more digitally focused than a number of other retailers that are out there. And Leighton, I know you live near a development, a fairly new development of all of Bed Bath & Beyond's retail brick and mortar outlets. What was your takeaway from this new construction there?
Yeah, it was actually opened just less than a year ago, and they have, again, all of their concepts, as you had mentioned, in one spot. And if you look at the sheer amount of real estate that it takes up, it's amazing. I did a little bit of digging, and if you look into the research of the development, it is actually rented. So you're going to be seeing more erosion of that bottom line because of extremely high lease agreements. You're seeing that this is actually super expensive real estate where these properties are. And overall, if you go inside these brand new stores, they're pretty much the same as they've ever been, just a little bit cleaner. And if you go in, the customer experience just was not there for me. I'm obviously not a frequent customer of Bed Bath & Beyond, but in anticipation of this earnings call, I decided to go in since these stores were new and they are obviously close to where I live. No one greeted me when I went into these stores, and a lot of these workers were actually prioritizing stocking over customer interaction. And that's something I wanted to draw into a story that I just read about Walmart neighborhood markets no longer having overnight stockers. I think it's sort of a misconception that you can get everything done at once during the day. I think there's going to be a lot of problems in terms of congestion, especially during the peak hours, if you have a lot of associates stocking items and not necessarily paying attention to your core customer. That being said, shares of Bed Bath & Beyond were down after this earnings call, and they've been down for quite some time, for over a year now, right now around $22.25 a share from around $27 a share before earnings, a 45% drop since this time last year. This represents an 8-year low and a market cap for the company around $3.2 billion. Current price to earnings ratio is around 5.7 with a dividend yield of 2.7%. However, if you look into that dividend, that may be something that is going to be sacrificed in the long term as the company looks to pivot more aggressively to appease their ever-growing digital consumer through their omni-channel platform and then those staffing needs. Again, trying to have everyone on board doing a certain task, it's going to be very expensive to train properly and to have what they call local experts in place. Well, in our last story, it's going to be a soft reminder that retail sales aren't quite as bad as the media sometimes makes them out to be. A study by Deloitte predicts that holiday sales are going to be up by another 4% this year. This is on top of the increase cited in 2016, which was also a similar 4% rise. Last year, when the 4% number came out, many raised eyebrows as the storylines were dominated by soft department store sales. We often hear about how indoor malls are dying. However, sales picked up in e-commerce channels and at certain other retailers, more than offsetting softness in some of those said department stores. For the study, Deloitte is looking at the months of November of 2017 and December through January 2018. They're predicting a rise of 4% to 4.5% over retail sales, excluding auto sales and fuel from last year. This would put total U.S. retail sales during this period at $1.04 to $1.05 trillion over last year. And last year saw retail sales during the same period peak at over just $1 trillion. This is a lot of money we're talking about. And we should note that this is on top of a strong 2016 comp as holiday retail sales grew approximately 4% last year. It's not necessarily all top line retail sales we're looking at here, though. It's the way in which retailers are scoring sales.
That's right. And what we mean by scoring sales is how they're bringing in sales overall. Deloitte predicts that e-commerce sales will rise 18 to 21% over last year. That's right in that sweet spot where Bed Bath & Beyond actually was with all of their e-commerce brands. They predict that during this point in time, again, November 1st to January 31st, that e-commerce sales will rise to a $111 billion to $114 billion overall. This is an increase from $94 billion a year ago. But even with this increase in e-commerce sales fueling some of the projected 4% overall increase, it's important to note that brick and mortar sales are projected to rise as well. Deloitte's model projects a $20 billion increase over the $906 billion in brick and mortar sales experienced last year. This comes out to a 2.2% increase year over year, which we feel is right at the level we would consider to be strong for a brick and mortar retailer. So again, this is an average increase across all of the brick and mortar realm if their numbers are correct. And 2.2% fairly robust, but keep in mind you do have your winners in this case. We've talked about Home Depot and Ulta Beauty and many other brands getting towards double digits in same store sales, where some same store sales are dropping for other brick and mortar outlets. And again, these aren't all same store sales. This takes into account new and newly opened locations. So not all of this 2.2% would be in the same store sales realm. Also, this is a good time to point out that despite all of the talk about e-commerce and Amazon, and certainly we are fairly bullish on e-commerce as a whole, e-commerce is still only projected to make up about 10.6% of overall retail sales this holiday season. So we hear all this stuff about e-commerce and Amazon still only making up, though, 10.6% of overall retail sales. Again, if Deloitte's numbers ring true, brick and mortar is still king here, despite what the media might have you think regarding brick and mortar versus e-commerce sales. This percentage, though, still is up from 9.4% of overall retail sales last holiday season. Let's take a look at some of the reasoning behind the increase for Deloitte, as they feel an increase in disposable income for most in the U.S. could fuel the overall retail sales increase. Daniel Bachman, Deloitte's senior editor, said that personal income has grown 2% year over year in 2016, and it could nearly double this year, meaning 2017. He gives the range of 3.8 to 4.2%. This is also with the ubiquitous economics caveat of having everything else constant, including savings rates and the overarching labor participation rate. It's very important to look at some of these macro factors that could spur demand for increased savings, such as the increased coverage of natural disasters in the media and, of course, all of these hurricanes. It's been widely talked about that, in fact, total damages from Irma and Harvey aren't 100% covered by homeowners insurance and FEMA floodplain coverages. So these people could be taking this personal income and stowing it away increasingly. Accordingly, it could be the home improvement sector here that sees the biggest increase in consumer spending during the holiday season, and not your traditional retailer. So we're not necessarily looking at gift giving. Lastly, donations from both individuals and businesses towards hurricane relief could also diffuse marketing campaigns and tighten holiday budgets. A report on August 30th by CNN Business stated that businesses had already donated close to $160 million to rebuilding efforts surrounding Harvey damages, and that number is only going to go up when you factor in Irma and whatever happens with the other additional hurricanes that could hit between now and the end of the year. Nevertheless, though, the retail indicators coming out of this year's data seems ripe for a strong holiday season. Rod Sides, the vice chairman of Deloitte, even used the word thriving when describing the current state of retail, and I don't think that's a word that we've heard too much elsewhere in the media. So Rod kind of sticking his neck out here. Additionally, he sees the specialty segments and disruptive nature of retail in general, not as obstacles, but as catalysts for continued industry growth, which is a breath of fresh air for those of us, including Leighton and I, that are basically surrounded by negativity in this area. Yeah, some companies like Bed Bath & Beyond or Toys R Us perhaps are struggling, but again, total sales figures indicate that other retailers, both big and small, are picking up where others have left off. After all, how often do we talk about positive earnings reports on this show? We had a show over the summer where it was basically every business having a positive earnings beat. And if Deloitte's words ring true, the holiday shopping season will be no different in this way.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, where Clayton and I give you a look ahead at stories that we're keeping an eye on over the next week or the next month. And in this circumstance, we'll begin with Leighton.
I'm looking ahead to a story that we sort of kind of covered last week during the Retail Focus podcast. We talked about Kohl's and a partnership with Amazon in certain locations, 10 locations to be exact, a store within the store concept where Amazon will feature its home devices and its Kindle Fire products. However, this is going to be a little different of a story, and this came out here recently this week. 82 Kohl's locations are going to be handling Amazon returns, and this really had media in an uproar and share prices for Kohl's going up. Rumors have already begun circling on the idea that Amazon may want to buy Kohl's, and they're testing out their customer service processes and those types of things to see if the company is worthy of an Amazon bid. Kohl's, if you look at their current market cap right now, it's around $7.58 billion. If you can compare that to the $13.8 billion Amazon just paid for Whole Foods Market, you can see that Amazon certainly can probably pay for Kohl's. And that is kind of crazy to think, because if you think of the massive amount of locations that Kohl's has throughout the United States, you can understand what kind of repercussion that would have in the retail industry. Obviously, there is value there because of their brick and mortar presence, but already you're seeing two different partnerships spur up from Amazon and Kohl's. A lot of analysts telling Kohl's to be careful because you don't want to give away too much to Amazon in terms of all that proprietary data and their overall store services. I think it's going to be an interesting story to follow as this partnership unfolds.
Well, for my story, I could have gone with Target rolling out their restock program to 8 new markets throughout the country, but since we've talked about that significantly in the past, I want to turn our attention to discount grocery retailer Aldi. Aldi, of course, operating Trader Joe's as well, but Aldi is opening new locations on the regular, and again, they're too in kind of a fight with Lidl to make sure they maintain market share here in the U.S. It's not only Kroger and Albertsons Safeway that are talking about this, but one thing that Aldi's done in the last week I really think will assist them in terms of boosting overall sales, and that's that they're now accepting forms of contactless payment, including Apple Pay, Google Wallet, and Android Pay. One of the downsides to shopping at Aldi for a long period in time is that they only accept certain forms of payment. But by opening up to multiple different forms of payment, they are also opening their doors to additional potential customers. And I think this is something that Aldi is certainly going to have to look at doing if they expect to continue their growth plans on into the future. We talked about it on this week's Food Focus podcast. The more forms of payment you take, the more potential customers you're retaining rather than chasing off. And so it's going to be vital for Aldi to start to add certain digital sales measures. Additionally, they announced a partnership last month with Instacart, which is a grocery delivery service. So Aldi, often thought about as a budget retailer, not thought about as a customer-forward retailer, but they're beginning to do some things that are shaking up their own brand and perhaps positioning themselves in not necessarily a premium place in the marketplace, but at least more similar to where a full-line grocery store would be going forward. That'll do it for us on the Retail Focus podcast. For Layton, I'm Trent. Again, next week, we'll be at the Shop.org conference in Los Angeles. Looking forward to that. Big thanks to Monica Kocher, our guest for today's show, and also to the UPSStoreFranchising.com/focus for stepping up as the show's sponsor. We'll be back next week with more retail news and information on all the traditional channels, including iTunes, Stitcher, and SoundCloud.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.